Welcome to Movie Crush, a production of iHeartRadio. Hey, everybody, and welcome to Movie Crush, Oscar Roundtable Edition. We are talking Uncut Gems. On my right, I have Mr. Casey Pegram.
Hey.
That's it.
That's the intro.
On my left, I have Noel.
Pew, 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 pew.
Oh, this is getting interesting.
Doing finger
Can't
guns.
Wait to see what across from me Paul
that's
has
That's my
to
new
say.
Thing for the year, by the way, is finger guns.
Finger guns.
And sound effects corresponding.
You're stealing Deal Paul's it. Thunder.
Hello, Paul.
Paul?
Hey, guys.
Oh, just that's so Paul.
The quiet restraint.
I love it.
Hey, this is me.
Is that your thing
this
for 2019?
This is how I win.
Classy guy. In fact, Casey was classy. Noel's the only one who guttered this up with pew-pew finger
well,
guns.
I missed my cue one time, so now I'm, I try to be on top of it.
Did you really?
Casey did kind of a Fonz kind of thing. He did sort of an A.
Yeah, and I'm trying not to do that. I don't want to do the A, and I don't want to do the whatever. I just want to be like, hey.
Well, that's weird.
Very straightforward.
Almost every time I see you in the office, you go, hey!
And you kick the jukebox.
That's true.
And your favorite song comes on.
The leather jacket
every
appears.
Time.
All right, Casey. I guess I'm not even going to know who you are anymore.
Yeah.
Real showboat over there.
So, dudes, we are here to talk about Uncut Gems. And I will go ahead and spoil by saying it was my favorite movie of the year.
Yeah, it's way
really?
Up there for
It's my
me.
Number one movie
way,
of the year.
Way up there for me.
It was everything about it was fucking perfect.
It was my number two. But it was neck and neck with my number one.
All right, hold your thumbs, though. We all liked it, unless Paul's like, meh, it was kind of okay. I thought the acting was not so great.
Paul's always the wild card, actually.
You never know what this
That's
guy's going
to
say.
That's the beauty of Paul.
We had a Richard Jewell discussion at the question mark table yesterday, and I was—
It was a good discussion.
Yeah, I respect your opinion, as always.
Yeah, thank you. I respect yours, usually.
Thanks. Okay, well, that's fine. I'll take that. So the Safdie brothers, the only movie I've seen of theirs is Good Time. Mm-hmm. Or is it Good Times?
Good Time.
Good Time.
Singular.
Which— Was fucking great.
Yeah,
I have not seen the one with the young junkie woman who.
Oh, heaven knows what.
Yeah, was did anyone see that?
It seems very unpleasant.
I meant to get around to it. I actually saw a deleted scene from it on YouTube, but I have not seen the straightforward feature yet.
I just know I knew in advance that it involves cutting, and I don't like I don't like cutting.
Yeah.
Cutting freaks and like suicide. That's sort of triggering for me, so I've avoided it.
Okay,
cutting and heroin addiction and
all that. It just seems like I said very unpleasant.
Some Ariel Pink music.
Well, I mean, the Safdie brothers. One thing they're not out to do so far in their career is make anyone feel comfortable and. Smiley.
No.
In a movie theater.
Yeah. They're very much watching one of their movies is like having a panic attack or something. So
especially Uncut Gems.
But I would argue a perfectly enjoyable, exciting experience.
I can't wait to see this again. It's not one of those where like, oh, I can't sit through that again.
No, yeah. I'm going tonight.
Are you?
Yeah.
Well, that's fantastic.
Yeah, I've seen it twice already.
So another thing, too, that has just hit me, there are so many great filmmakers out there right now, and we're really lucky. But to be like our age— Of course, I'm much older than you guys. We don't need to say the obvious. But, you know, to be a movie-going person and to be seeing their career at the very beginning at this juncture is like, I just feel so excited about what's to come.
Although they've been doing it since mid-2000s, I want to say.
Yeah.
They have like—
Yeah, they had a
least,
few other
Pleasure of Being Robbed and Daddy Long Legs, a.k.a. Go Get Some Rosemary. I think those are the four features they've done, that and Good Time and Uncut Gems. They might have one more in there, but—
A lot of shorts.
Yes, tons of shorts and also some documentary work and, you know, their IMDb is quite full of stuff, but they're only now, like Good Time was kind of like the moment where they really popped and then—
Sure, as far as big mainstream American films.
Yeah, and then certainly like that, like Good Time was the thing that allowed them to get Sandler for this movie and so it's just all kind of snowballing.
And we had briefly talked on the last Mini Crush episode we recorded about how they had this script like right out of film school.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I read that it went through like over 100 revisions.
Yeah.
And they'd kind of been nursing it for about 10 years. And they wrote it for Sandler, but they weren't famous enough to get him. And they got it to one of his reps and they, you know, passed or just, you know, just sat in a stack or something.
Yeah.
And then when Pattinson, you know, was involved in a Good Time and it, you know, made such a splash. I think Sandler saw it like at Venice or Cannes or something. Yeah.
And he like, there's, I was listening to one of the many podcasts that the Safdies have been doing to promote this. And one of the, I forget if it was Josh or Benny, but got a text just saying like, hey man, your movie's great. And he wrote back like, hey, who's this? He's like, Sandler. And he's like, what, so-and-so Sandler? Like, you know, some guy that he knew. He's like, no, the famous one. And he named some other guy as like an architect or something. He's like, no, dummy, the comedian, the famous guy. He's like, oh, shit. You know?
That's pretty funny.
That's very funny.
And what's interesting, too, about the way Good Time came about was that Robert Pattinson saw...
Heaven knows what.
Apparently, he didn't
he saw
even
a still from
he
it.
Saw a still from, like, a screenshot from the movie.
What?
And he loved it so much that he got in touch with the Safdies and said, I want to work with you guys.
From a screenshot?
Yes.
That's amazing.
From, you know, like some purple and orange and green, beautiful lighting.
Super dreamy.
And they were trying to get, I mean, for a long time, get Uncut Gems made. But then when Pattinson came along, they were like, this isn't really something that
works for him.
Let's just put Uncut Gems aside and we're going to write something totally new for him.
While we've got somebody like a big star.
Yeah.
And it's smart.
It's crazy that the genesis of that was kind of like, let's write something for Pattinson.
Yeah, they just busted it out. Yeah.
And they bust out Good Time, which is amazing.
Yeah. That's crazy. Yeah. And who was the one that was in that movie?
Is
which
it Benny?
Oh, yeah. Benny is the brother.
The actor.
Yeah, Connie's brother.
Yeah.
Boy, he was good too as an actor.
Fantastic.
It's almost like an Of Mice and Men kind of vibe with that movie, where it's like he's the younger, kind of super conniving, kind of huckster that's trying to protect his brother, but ultimately puts him in harm's way.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, what a movie.
Yeah, highly recommended. I think you can watch that.
It's
for
on
free on
Amazon
Prime. As well as Annie in the City, Annie in the City, Amazon Prime.
There you go.
Right now. Uncut Gems, little background. They wrote this film a long time ago, like you said, but apparently they grew up with a father who worked in the Diamond District. And that's why this film feels so authentic. I read one article where they spent a lot of these years getting in on the inside, because apparently the Diamond District and these dudes are just very protective and very skeptical. And it took him years to get access and to get behind these doors, and they finally sort of – and this is – like their father worked in the Diamond District, and it was still hard for them to get sort of the insider look. And they did, and they use – you know, they're I think, next to the Coen brothers, the greatest directors we have so far about using real people as actors. It's – and I always wonder why more directors don't do that, because it makes such a difference when you have someone that's clearly not an actor doing a good job. And I think it's hard.
It's
difficult.
It's
a real skill.
It's a real long process of finding those people.
Mm-hmm.
Number one, finding somebody interesting who comes from that world, but then also somebody who has all those characteristics but can also still be natural on camera and not panic that they're in a scene with Adam Sandler.
Yeah, you got to set
Pattinson.
Them up for success.
Yeah.
It's in fact, the lead actor in this, where is she? What's her name? I got it right here in front of me.
Julia Fox?
Yes. Yeah. She was a first-time actor.
Yeah, yeah. I was not familiar with her, but I guess she's got a rep as like kind of a NYC socialite, like
seamster
kind of person.
Yeah, it's sort of like that that woman in the Florida Project who was like an Instagram model or something.
Yeah, exactly.
And she just crushed.
Absolutely.
And again, that's another great example of like that's about being a good director.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's about like how do you put this person in context and then like and actually, you know, you have to – We know how many cuts there are in scenes and how so many of them are pieced together from little fragments and stuff. You've got to like direct the hell out of these people a lot of the time, I imagine. You know, maybe not, but
she was fantastic.
So good.
Kevin Garnett was good.
Oh, yeah. He's great.
I mean, he's a non-actor.
Yeah.
I'm such a sports non-person. I didn't even know he was a real basketball
player. You don't even know how to say that you're not into sports.
Yeah, exactly.
You're a sports non-person.
A non-person. But it makes sense after the fact because all those games were real, all the basketball games, and like the stats were all real stats. And because, God, can you imagine how much it would have cost to stage those just to have them on TV? You know, like, but he like – they were obviously – he's been out of the game for a while now.
So he's retired, yeah.
Yeah. This was set in what, 2012?
The 2012 finals. I was just reading – there's a great New Yorker profile on the Safdies and the movie, and one of the most fascinating tidbits about it is that they did not license the NBA footage that they used in the movie.
Oh, really?
It's all fair use.
They just basically quote-unquote stole it, and they're going to defend it as fair use because they didn't alter the outcome or change anything of the order of what happened in it.
Is the NBA made a statement?
I don't think so. It's just insane to me. Yeah. Like, you know, professional sports to me is like when it comes to licensing footage.
They're really serious.
Really, especially like, say, the NFL. Like, yeah. I don't know the NBA specifically, but the fact that the Safdies were just like, you know what, fuck it. We're just going to do it.
It's pretty ballsy.
That's wow. pretty ballsy. And yeah. that the studio was, you know, A24 was like
cool with it.
Standing behind them yeah. for it, which is crazy.
That's yeah. like trying to use an Eagles song in your movie. Because Don Henley will fucking sue your ass yeah. if you look at him sideways.
Yeah, yeah.
Very that's litigious. Interesting.
I don't understand how fair use applies to that. Because it's not, I mean, I guess part of a fair use argument is that you're transforming it or making it like satire or something like that. But like if they're just using it as is in their movie.
I guess if you regard it as almost like history or something, but I don't know. Maybe. I don't know if that's like
I don't think the fair use thing would
yeah,
actually hold
really
up.
I don't think
up.
So either.
I mean, they're not really commenting on it either. They're kind yeah. of – they're building a story around it, but they're not like yeah. saying this is the story of what happened in that yeah. series.
That's right. They're fictionalizing. Yeah, it, you know. But also, of, yeah. fair use usually has to have some sort of newsworthy element right. to it as well, yeah. which this obviously yeah. doesn't either.
I mean, it's good
that
for the NBA.
Fascinating.
It really gets people talking about basketball, and
yeah. yeah,
I mean, it's a central part of the film.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And how it like ruins people's lives and stuff.
Sports betting, man.
Oh my god,
I don't understand
let's get,
it,
let's, dude. Let's get into that. Just yeah. the
well,
whole,
I have a little history yeah, there. Does yeah. anyone else ever bet on sports?
No, I didn't even know it was legal. I didn't even, I mean.
Is that how, like, out of the loop you are? You didn't know you could bet on sports?
I thought you had to have, like, a bookie or something. I didn't know you could just walk into a casino and do it.
In Vegas,
oh,
yeah.
sure. Yeah. yeah, it's called the sports book.
Yeah.
yeah.
It's
I
a
didn't
big
know that.
Room with 500 TVs, and it's the greatest place on
was
earth.
Was there not no. a time where that kind of betting was not legal?
Well, I mean, it depends on, it's illegal in Georgia.
Yeah. Okay,
but there's
it.
Still bookies in Georgia because I used to bet. I've had two experiences with gambling. Well, I'll say three. In college, I bet on college basketball when I don't know if you're into basketball a little bit, right?
A little bit, yeah.
The UNLV Rebels in the 90s with Larry Johnson and Stacey Augman. It was
okay, yeah.
It was like a like infamous, legendary college basketball team. So during that era, I bet on college basketball, but it was always like college bookies, $20 on a game or
sure,
something.
Sure, sure.
Flash forward to when I lived in New Jersey, I bet on sports. With my friend James, and it got a little more serious.
Uh-huh.
And it built up to one uncut Jimsy moment when I was down $1,000, which was a really, really big deal to me at the time.
Sure.
It was pretty catastrophic. I don't know if I had $1,000. I don't know if I would have gotten like my legs broken.
Right.
Was that kind of deal?
Yeah.
But it was a big deal. And I, that weekend, do not advise this anyone. Placed three, and this was all bets, so like $150 maybe. It just, I kept getting, you know, I kept losing.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's on a weekly thing, so I lost all week. Going into the weekend, I was down 1,000, and I placed three $350 bets.
Shit.
Wow.
And I won them all.
Wow.
Wow.
And didn't bet again after
you were,
that.
You were out after that?
I was out after wow. that. And then the only time I've bet since then, the third wave was – I hate Vegas, but occasionally I've had to go when I was living in LA, and I would always go into the sports book with oh, yeah. like $200 and put some money on some games.
I like just walking through that room because you can feel the energy, you can feel kind of the
boy, it's
the
a
tension and everything.
Pretty tense room.
It's fun to just kind of like cruise through there for a minute and kind of observe that world.
It is yeah. really interesting, and I will say this as a big sports fan, gambling on sports is really like. Invigorating.
That's how to make it count, right? That's how to like yeah, up the stakes and like get involved in the game.
Big yeah. time. It's a fucking rush. Like yeah. I get it. When I was watching this movie, I totally got it. And the end.
Oh, yeah.
I don't bet anymore. It's been a long time.
That was like the most I've ever understood watching sports was watching Sandler watch that game and just every victory, like the fucking tip-off.
Oh, God.
The sickness of parlaying the tip-off into the other bets, you know?
I had a stomach ache yeah. when he made that the opening yeah. bet. Of, just so you don't, so you know, a parlay yeah. means you have to win all three bets
right.
to win yeah. the bet.
Right.
And the opening
and the first
tip,
one is just nonsense.
It, yeah.
Like
yeah.
It could go, it's a coin yeah. toss, you
it's
know?
It's like betting on the yeah. Super Bowl
so,
coin toss.
But he's so confident that it's going to happen. And then it does, and it's like that could have tanked everything.
Well, he has that line
on that
like,
one.
He's like,
oh,
yes,
guys, that
we
was the hardest
if we
one.
Didn't win that way.
Yeah, that was the hardest one, guys. Everything's good from now on. Yeah. Everything's good.
Yeah.
Wow. Oh, God, that whole scene wow. was just like,
oh my
God. Yeah,
maybe so mild spoilers set it up right.
No, all
oh,
this
yeah.
is going to be spoiled.
Okay. Spoil it.
Yeah, man. Oh, again, I'm not a sports guy. I don't really get it, but I got it.
Yeah.
When there are those stakes, and also, but the way he behaves, he's like a drug addict. He's like a junkie.
Yeah.
And he's just, you know, all rhyme or reason goes out the window, and he starts to like. You start to almost develop this weird kind of admiration for him,
sure.
Where you're like, he knows something that I don't know, and this is a skill for him. But then you also realize he does it.
Yeah.
But maybe he does. And the way he's talking to Garnett when he's like, he gets worked up into this frenzy where he's like, you know, this is how I win.
Yeah.
The big line for the movie where he. He thinks he's got some sort of insight into this guy's mind and how he's going to behave.
Because of that gem.
Because of this gem that he's like his totem now.
It adds this sort of mystical quality to it.
Totally, dude. You know? Totally.
But I think there's an element to something valid there because I know like a lot of athletes are very superstitious.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it's like I've got to have my special glove or my special pants or my special socks or whatever.
Yep.
And, you know, it may be BS in the kind of material objective domain, but – if it's affecting the psychology and the confidence of that player, it is as real as anything else. So he knew that that gym was like the thing that was going to make KG crush that game.
Yeah.
He could feel it. And so that gave him that edge. It's almost like insider trading. Like he knows this guy is going to go out there and just like go
it's
nuts.
Like
you know,
insider trading. But like, how are you going to enforce? Like, you know what I mean? Like,
how would
you call? Oh, you knew that he had the magic stone that was going to make him crush.
Well, that's the thing is there is nothing enforceable. Gambling like that is all about trying to get as much insider information as possible.
It's like in Casino when De Niro finds out, you know, is the quarterback's girlfriend pregnant? Like, what kind of wood is on the court? All that kind of stuff. Like, any edge you can get is going to move
point.
The odds
it's
in
all
your favor.
Fair. The idea of edge, it's nonsense.
Yeah.
Like, on paper kind of way. But to the person in their mind, and if you think you have an insight into that, it's money in the bank, I guess, theoretically. But it's all bullshit. It's bullshit to the guy who thinks this is a magic rock, but he believes it, therefore it's not.
Maybe
bullshit.
He's playing better.
Who knows?
Yeah. I like what you said about you as a viewer, you kind of develop an admiration for Sandler's character. And right before we came in here, I pulled up the script, which you can find online, and the cover page of it under the title, it just says in all capitals, "In Howard We Trust."
Oh, wow.
And I think there's a sense that, I mean, obviously, you know, the movie was probably loosely inspired, like we said, by their father.
Yeah.
But there's a sense of, like, even though he is kind of a scumbag in some ways, the Safdies clearly have a lot of love or admiration for them, even though they still acknowledge he's in a downward spiral, you know, and all the negative qualities of him. There's something, I don't know, sort of, it almost relates to, like, the American dream.
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, you're rooting for him.
Yeah, you are. Even though you know this is only going to end one of two ways.
Yeah. Uh-huh,
you know, it can only go you can only have the best possible outcome or the worst possible outcome.
Yeah, there really is no middle ground.
There's no middle ground.
Yeah.
And what I love about the lead up to the very ending when he's watching the game is how the sort of antagonist of the movie, Arno, who also happens to be his, like, brother-in-law.
Yeah,
Eric Bogosian?
Yes.
Yeah.
When he's locked in that entryway.
Yeah.
He's so fed up with Sandler's character, but as the game is going on,
he's getting into it.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And he's sort of, you know, he's softening.
This might actually happen.
This might actually happen.
He's asking his henchmen, like, what does it say on the screen? Are we winning? What's going on?
Yeah,
you know?
Like he
and
can't
then his
help.
Eyes start to lighten up. And
yep.
He can't help but be drawn in just the way
family.
Sandler is.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
Well, and that's why, I mean, we can go ahead and talk about the ending. Well, that's why that ending is such a fucking
so
gut
tragic,
punch.
Yeah.
Because he wins, he's happy. Guys, let me let you out of your little prison.
Yeah.
We did it.
Yeah.
Boom.
Yeah. Headshot.
I mean, just
unceremonious.
Like,
and then the fact that Arno gets offed as well.
Yeah, man.
What's funny,
hardcore.
Though, I didn't find it sad per se.
It's not in a way because you think, like, realistically, what's this guy going to do with that million? He's going to go fucking bet that too,
oh, I know.
Right?
It's not like so he's going to make
what is
better
he divvy it up?
Yeah,
like what did he think was going to happen here?
Yeah.
Like, what did any of that, like, I mean.
It's just like, and, you know, he's going to keep doing it until he can't do it anymore, right?
Yeah.
So at least this way he goes out, like, on top. He's experiencing this moment of, like, pure ecstasy and
that's
victory and so on.
It
and
is a happy moment.
And then he's dead before he knows
smile
it,
on
you know?
His face,
yeah, that's true.
You know?
He's not laying there thinking, like, oh, my God, I've been killed because of my actions. Like,
yeah.
It's just
it's
he's
over,
elated.
In a blink
and then
of an eye,
he's sitting up in heaven going, what the fuck happened?
Yeah.
That was great.
And what I love, too, is the person who actually ends up with the money is Julia Fox's character.
Yeah.
And, you know, who knows what's going to happen after the fact, but right. I like the idea that she kind of might end up with all this money.
Yeah. Right.
She's
yeah.
kind of the unsung hero of right. this, you yeah. know?
And it was so interesting, too, because at first you think that she's, like, using him or that she's yeah. some sort of, like,
it's
you
very
know,
complex.
That she's using him or that she's in some way playing him.
It's like a sugar daddy.
Yeah, sugar daddy
but
situation.
But you realize that she genuinely, like, him. Loves him.
Yeah. I think yeah. they do love each other.
Yeah. yeah.
Is that the take?
Yeah,
I think so.
I think that, and I
her
think there's
anyway.
A deeper theme of like she's kind of the only one in a way that sees the true potential maybe of Howard that he mm-hmm. is this sort of uncut gem that he has this thing within him that
yeah.
is you know worth loving, worth caring about, mm-hmm. where everyone else just sees a complete screw up. You know,
oh man, his family, his daughter, and his wife is just yeah. they just fucking loathe him.
Yeah,
man. It's
yeah.
so cutting. Both of those scenes, the one with the daughter at the fridge.
Ugh.
He's inconsequential. And
yeah.
then the stuff with the wife at the end when she's laughing in his face.
Yeah. yeah.
It's just
and he's
like,
he's like, I want you to hit me. And she fakes it.
Yeah.
And he like, flinches, you know, flinches or whatever.
Yeah.
The thing, too, that was really striking about like the different environments that he kind of inhabits. When he's at home, he feels so out of his element.
Yes.
Yeah.
It doesn't make sense for him to be there when
yeah.
he's at that school play, so out of his element.
He's always trying to leave.
He's well, yeah, and he's
yeah.
always on his phone. That's
uh-huh.
that was a thing that resonated yeah. with me actually. Just the obsession with like go go go, constantly update, check. You know all
yeah.
my
yeah.
even about his social stats and you know tag me on Instagram
right,
and that
right,
whole
right.
shit. Like
yeah.
he's so obsessed with that too.
Yeah. Well, again, he is this embodiment almost of like a certain Americanness. You know of like contemporary Americanness.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say like the obsession with. The kind of narcissism, the sort of like obsession with online, the obsession
mm-hmm.
with just what's new, what's hot, what's coming
status.
In, you know, and status and winning and novelty and you know he's on this sort of like it feels like with the Julia Fox character, he's not really. I mean, I guess he's into it in some ways, but it almost seems like he's just kind of going through the motions in a way of having this like apartment and like this kind of like mistress, and it just feels like he doesn't really derive any pleasure from anything other than the gambling, you know, other
it's,
than
it's
like
all
upping
about the hustle,
stakes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And everything else is just kind of like, you know, just what he feels obligated to do, I guess, in some weird way.
And it's the thrill and the high from. Like you said, the constant hustle,
mm-hmm.
not just of the wins, but also of the losses.
Maybe even more.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
it's like he loves both of them
yeah.
just to
yeah.
be in it and, you know, being able to sort of craft some high-stakes life for himself.
Yeah, because right, then you have right. a chance to dig yourself out if you're losing.
Yeah.
yeah.
And
yeah.
what's more invigorating, I mean, I had my stupid little story, and I got to tell you, dudes, when I won those three bets, that was better than my wedding day. No.
Yeah.
it's a high, you know,
yeah.
to feel, because you feel like you've beaten someone.
Well, it's like Howard says, you know, he wins one, or maybe it's when he gets the gem, I think, and he says, holy shit, I'm going to fucking come.
Yeah,
and,
yeah, yeah.
And it's really funny. There's this moment where the Safdies actually use CGI to shrink his eyeballs down and make them smaller.
Really?
Nobody noticed this, but somebody compared a screenshot of like the same shot from before and then after. If you do it side by side, you
it's
can
like
see the
endorphin rush.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Literally.
You can see the eyes
that's
are
cool.
like physically shrunk down. There's this really funny thing on Twitter where somebody tweeted that at the Safdies, and they replied like, you know, good eye.
Nice
like,
catch.
Nice catch. But then they were also like, how'd you get those screenshots? Because it's not in the trailer. It's not floating around. It's from a screener that's kind of
wait
been,
a minute. And then they went, oh, yeah, well, you stole from the NBA. So.
Yeah, exactly.
That's a good
you can't
point.
Say shit.
Yeah.
It's interesting, too, because, like, by all accounts, like, by any metric that anybody like the four of us would have, he's successful. He's got the apartment in the city.
He's got
the dope
house,
house
in
New Jersey
or
Long Island
yeah,
or whatever.
Yeah.
He's got the Idina Menzel as his wife,
uh-huh.
you know. He's got the kids. He's got the car. He's got the successful jewel shop or whatever. I wonder, is it like, is he maintaining? Is his I think it's just about the obsession and the
yeah,
high.
Yeah.
I don't think he's – I think he doesn't need the money per se.
Well, I think the Passover scene especially, I feel like – is really showing that to somebody else, this could be just a great life, just
mm-hmm.
to be content with what he has, this family, this tradition, his success, and so on. But to him, it's like nothing. He takes it all for granted. And the only way he can feel alive is to just up the stakes and risk it all and almost throw it all away or whatever.
And that sort of gets to the contemporary Americanness of the whole thing. And the fact that, too, like the reason he's doing all this is probably because he sees it as an escape from kind of the boring, suburban, mundane life of being a husband and a father. Mm-hmm. Like I love when he's at home and his wife keeps telling him to go talk to his son in bed, you know, put him in bed, and then he finally does, and then he's just on his phone watching the game the whole time.
That was just
having
those
quiet, like,
stomach hurt,
like under his breath.
Oh yeah, yay!
And then his older son, has basically become him.
Oh yeah, man,
he's already bet on the game too.
Very
smaller
key
stage.
Scene, yeah. That really small scene, but it was so key.
He's got all the basketball memorabilia, and he's clearly like thinks his dad is the coolest person in the world, you know.
Well, let's jump back real quick to the beginning. One of my favorite things about this movie is, and they didn't have to do this, but they started out in the mine, in the gym mine, and it was just like there's something about that sequence and following that gemstone and then how it ends too, which we'll get to. Just really like knocked my socks off.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Added a lot to the movie.
And a sense of scale.
A sense of scale, and I think it reminds you of the sort of the class and racial context of the movie. Much like a lot of people have talked about how Good Time is very aware of how Robert Pattinson's character is this white man who's able to do all these things at the expense of people of color.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
This movie with that opening kind of reminds you of where all this is coming from and the exploitation of labor and all that. And it gets addressed in the movie when him and KG are talking about the gem.
What did you pay for it versus what are you going to charge?
Was he being honest there? Do you think he paid $100,000 for it?
Yeah, and I think actually I didn't notice this until the second time watching it, but it's $100,000 that he owes to Arno in the first place.
Uh-huh.
So I think that's the $100,000 that he borrowed from him to buy the opal in the first place.
Oh,
you're totally right.
So it's all circular. And the crazy thing about it is that, you know, when it goes to auction, it finally sells for what, like $190
to Judd Hirsch.
To Judd Hirsch.
His father-in-law.
So he's going to have to pay him back. I think it's almost $40,000 on top of just giving him the money back. So now he's only made what, like $135 or something?
Well, and that's what he was talking about when KG asked him.
Yeah.
That was kind of one of the defeatist parts.
And then like you think about all this other money that he's got tied up in like pawning the watch or pawning the championship ring and everything. Like he's probably going to break even at the end of all this. Like if he lives, you know, if he doesn't place that
which
insane
is a
bet.
Win for him though.
Yeah.
As
yeah,
an addict, yeah. as a gambling addict, you break even, you're like, all right, I'm not out any money.
But that's
and I got to rush for a few days.
When he gets that money, you know, he gets like he's finally got it. He can just give the money over to Arno in the goons and
many moments where, I mean, it's a movie about a character who does nothing but make the wrong decisions.
Yeah.
Starting from the very beginning, I was like, oh, God, don't let him leave without fucking Jim.
Yeah.
Like, it's Kevin Garnett, but still, just don't do it, man. This is going to be a bad thing.
Do some paperwork or something, you know.
Yeah.
Bare minimum.
And he lets him walk out. Lakeith Stanfield was so good.
Yeah.
He's great in everything.
Oh, yeah.
Boy,
yeah.
He was
but
good in
really
this.
Really instrumental.
It's great
character.
Great to compare his performance in this and his performance in like
Knives
Out.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
He's two so
completely different
dude.
Characters.
He's so
and, yeah.
versatile. I think he's brilliant. Yeah.
He feels like one of the – like he could be one of the non-actors that they cast or something. He just fits that role so like – he just feels like a natural fit.
Yeah.
Boy, the non-actors in this were great. Some of those creeps.
Yeah.
The one guy that just keeps kind of popping up.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I mean, I can't remember how much he owes him. It's not even that much. He's sort of a small timer.
Yeah, yeah.
But he's always there just sort of, I think, to drive home that thing of like, this guy walks a block down New York and there's not going to be someone that's like, hey, wait, come on.
Yeah.
Like, what do you owe me?
I thought this was really smart. I kind of thought they were planting the seed for that guy to like take him out.
Sure.
Yeah,
because he was giving him
such a
small character. He was being so like dismissive to him because he only owes him $30,000 or whatever. Yeah. And he's like, fuck, get the fuck out of my face.
I think that was a misdirect.
I think it was too. Yeah. No, I think it definitely was because he kept popping up and like knocking on the door. And I figured there was going to be that one time where he just walks up and shoots him in the face. You know?
There's a bunch of misdirects in the movie. Like there's that scene where Adam Sandler and his family get home and his wife tells him to take out the garbage and it follows him for a really long time while he's rolling these trash cans down the driveway
at like
night.
He's whack. That's
and
the
he
whack
feels
scene.
Like he's going to get down to the end of the driveway and Arno's going to be there or whatever. Something's going to happen. Similarly, when he goes to the apartment and like the Madonna song is playing, Rain. And
you think she's going to be dead or
exactly.
something.
Uh-huh. That's what I thought. Uh-huh. She's going to be like hanging somewhere, dead in the bathtub or something. and nothing happened.
But instead,
you know?
She just had taken her stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Very orderly, yeah. You know. Like,
but there's several moments like that where we're trained as a viewer to get really tense and expect the worst, and then just nothing happens.
The Safdies are playing the audience like a fucking fiddle.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because they give you those little reprieves every now and then. But other than that, it's just the Passover scene was probably the quietest, longest quiet sequence. But other than that, it's just a wire that they just – it's like a guitar string you keep tightening and you're like, oh, God, when is that thing going to pop?
Even the stuff at the house is tense.
Yeah.
Just the dynamic between him and his family and his wife and his like constant obsession and you realizing, dude, you are fucking up as a family man.
Yeah.
Like you are a terrible father. Yeah. And you know, me as a father, I see that and that's triggering for me where I'm like – dude, you suck. Like, and it made me see, like, maybe I'm on my phone too much. Maybe I'm not being present enough for my kid. But this guy is the extreme version of that.
And you felt like a pretty good dad walking out of that movie, didn't you?
Damn right I did.
It's so sad, too. Like, when he's.
I've never gotten shoved naked into a trunk in my kid's. Oh, God,
that part was so great.
It's so sad when he's telling his kids like, hey, I'm gonna go into the city for
dude,
like a
cool
show
thing.
Tonight.
Ooh.
It's this guy the weekend, you know, and they're just like, you're not cool, dude. Like you shouldn't be trying to be cool with your kid.
And
anyway,
he isn't cool.
No, he's the old guy.
He's a joke.
He's a bummer. Yeah,
And he's wearing this goofy outfit, and everyone else is young and
tacky, sexy
and cool,
and
he's just so out of place and making a scene, and like gets thrown out on his ass.
Yeah.
You know,
God, the sequence where he. Where Lakeith Stanfield shows up, he doesn't have the gym, and he's like, you're fucking driving me to Philly right now. And they go down there. He gets all the way to Philly and gets – because he goes to take a layup and like play around for a second.
Makes an ass of himself
and then
right
gets
away.
Locked out of the locked out of the locker room, and Lakeith Stanfield's just like, nope.
Yeah.
I kept thinking like, oh, he's going to come back and get him. But no, he has to get on a plane to go back to New York.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Make it back to his kid's recital.
He
in
did
time.
It all to himself, you know? He shouldn't have given him the fucking gem in the first place.
He's his
place.
Own worst enemy in that way.
That does remind me of the scene, or when he's watching the basketball game at the end, there's a shot of KG like in the locker room at halftime.
Yeah, yeah.
And you hear the coach's voice like giving them the pep talk.
Right.
And they actually got Doc Rivers. Like in the credits, it's actually Doc Rivers. They got to do the voice of that.
Oh, did he – that was an ADR line?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, which is pretty awesome. And I think
– oh, it was meant to be footage? Was it meant to be like –
well, no, it's a shot.
They recreate.
In the locker room.
Yeah, they recreate.
With the gym by his locker.
Yeah, but you hear like the coach kind of giving the
I remember that.
Pep talk, but that is the actual – the guy who's at the actual coach at the
you
time.
Can tell. I mean, if you know Doc Rivers' voice, then
I didn't know his voice, so I was like, I wonder if that was. And then the credits, it's like,
that's pretty great.
But that reminds me of the way the film weaves actual history with this story, which is pretty great. And it, you know, if you read some interviews with them talking about how they got the movie made, like one of the reasons they kept rewriting the script was because depending on which basketball player they might be able to get, they would have to rewrite it, you know, to take
a
place.
Different series, different year.
Different series, different finals or whatever. Yeah. Like at one point they were talking to Amari Stoudemire.
Yeah, yeah. I think that was the original guy they wanted.
A few other people. And so, you know, me watching it, I didn't remember the outcome of the finals.
I didn't either, man.
You know?
And I remember that series, and that's interesting because I was thinking, I mean, that's part of the great, you know, thing about that sequence is you don't know which way it's going
to
go.
And the way it sort of rewrites history to tie it all to the gem, and then how the actual NBA footage at the end, they interview KG, and he's like, it was just me and The Rock.
Yeah.
And, of course, he's talking about the basketball, it's recontextualizing.
I didn't think about that.
Yeah. It's funny. My friend from Boston, Mark Finney, he's a filmmaker. Good dude. I knew him through Emily back in the L.A. days. He great small independent film he made called Fat, by the way. You can seek that out. But Finney is obsessed with this movie. Favorite movie, like – of the year for sure, on Facebook. But he's a big Boston guy, so I was curious if he remembered the outcome and how that affected – it's got to take something out of it if you're like, oh, no, I remember the Celtics won and KG had like whatever – definitely covered his point total.
Maybe, but you don't know. You may not remember that he made the tip off or something, you know?
Right,
there's
exactly.
Little like the kind of nonsensical parlay stuff, the prop bets.
Yeah.
Nobody would remember unless.
And I had never
like
heard that bet where everything counts as a point.
Yeah,
like a basket, a rebound. What
else? Just
got
to cover 26, like whatever.
Yeah,
that
yeah.
Thing is. Yeah.
So nerve-wracking. let's talk about the score for a second.
Oh yeah,
because it may be my favorite score of all time now.
It's way up there for me.
I mean, it was like classic and like and sort of it shouted out to like Vangelis,
mm-hmm. yes.
and some of this
there's one track that's very, very much like something on the Akira soundtrack.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but
it's
like Vangelis.
It's got a lot of that percussion.
Yeah.
But it's just – and the one with the like the chanting.
Yes, which is very kind of Philip Glass, like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
The kind of choral minimalist – you know, Daniel LePatin, the composer – He's remixed Philip Glass. He's remixed Steve Reich. He's very, very, very aware of a lot of trends in 20th century composition,
mm-hmm.
you know, classical, experimental, pop as well. He's a very, very important figure, I think, in contemporary music overall.
Well, he's essentially credited with inventing the vaporwave
exactly.
movement, which is sort of like a recontextualization of like esoteric 80s and 90s easy listening type music,
like
or video game music.
Just anything disposable.
And it'll sample things from like old TV commercials.
Right.
And it's all this kind of mashup, but ultimately danceable and kind of fun, chill wave kind of like, you know, sound.
But almost as like a commentary on like the emptiness of that. There's
it's
a
all bubble
deep,
gum,
deep
right,
undercurrent of sadness to a lot of that vaporwave stuff. And
then his solo stuff as Ono Trix, how is that?
Ono Trix.
Ono Trix Point yeah. Never really takes that even further and gets even more like, I don't know, he's forging his own kind mm-hmm. of mashup genre. And then his film work is much more arpeggiated synth-driven
yes.
and
yeah.
percussion and much more like you said, like a Vangelis or like a Tangerine Dream
yes.
or something.
Yeah.
It's very much that 80s.
Again, there's a track in
but
this.
But contemporary at the same
yeah.
time.
Very, very much so, yeah.
Yeah, there's a track in this that's also quite similar to one of the tracks on Sorcerer that Tangerine Dream scored for
yeah.
William Friedkin, which I think Friedkin's a big influence on the Safdies in general.
Clearly. Yeah. I mean, I'm a huge fan of that sound, like Giorgio Moroder, Tangerine Dream, all that stuff.
Yeah.
Like, really, really love that.
Yeah.
And it works in this movie so well. I mean, part of being a good score is working with the film and not just being like some awesome piece of music. And it just really provided the perfect sort of background to all this stuff.
I read a thing where the ratio of music parts to non-music parts is very high.
It's like 52 minutes of music,
yeah,
I think,
and
134, mm-hmm. 100, yeah, something minutes.
I haven't listened to it yet, just a
part. Oh, it's great.
No, me neither.
Yeah. I've been listening to it a lot.
He did the Good Time soundtrack as
yes.
well, which this is almost like a jacked up version of the Good Time soundtrack.
Yeah.
They're
yeah.
very similar, but this one clearly there was more budget. Like it's more orchestral. It
yeah.
has much more of these huge.
Well, and the chanting sort of recalled yeah. the early stuff. The gym mine, it just
yeah.
sort of
yeah.
all like worked
That's
together,
right.
I think.
Yeah.
I was listening to yet another podcast, I think, with the Safdies, and but Daniel LePatin was there as well. And he basically was saying that what they were trying to do with the score was almost bring out the inner life, the inner feeling of the Howard Ratner character, something that not to just reinforce what's on screen, but to give it like another dimension. And I think it really, really works. There's some of these tracks you wouldn't necessarily they're not the obvious way to score the scenes, let's say.
Yeah.
They are certainly driving, but a lot of times they're these kind of like major key, like upbeat sort of things. And, you know, you may be feeling like this guy is destined for like tragedy as you're watching it, but you're feeling this kind of lift, and it's kind of giving you insight into his own internal kind of state that
mm-hmm.
he's in a state of kind of ecstasy or something
yeah.
in these moments, even though we as viewers know that he's kind of maybe doomed. It's just a very, very interesting way that that they work with music. It's not, you know, traditional film scoring.
That's really interesting. It almost puts you in his mindset
exactly.
a little bit.
Yeah.
And it's a druggy movie somehow.
Yes, yes. Well, Good Time as well. Maybe even more so.
The
mixed lighting and
it's kind of psychedelic,
yeah.
but also obviously super speedy.
Yeah,
like there's a couple of druggy feelings.
And
in this
yet,
movie.
No one does drugs in this movie. Actually,
The Weeknd does coke in the.
Yeah,
in the,
there's
that's
a little
okay.
bit of
that's,
that,
but
yeah.
that's a very minimal,
yeah, yeah, yeah. Sure, sure.
quick.
Yeah,
snort
does,
in the
does
bathroom
Howard,
thing. You know?
Howard ever do drugs? In
no,
that?
No,
no.
So, this
man.
Is his drug. I don't think
yeah,
he does.
Yeah,
I
gambling
think,
is true.
I don't think
yeah.
he.
I don't think he drinks
touches
either.
Stuff.
I don't think he does anything.
No, you never. No,
he's
even
a
at
teetotaler.
That, he's not at that party to party.
Right.
He's
yeah.
there to like
get
you know hustle
back.
And get
yeah.
his gym back.
Yeah. And just kind of make the scene.
Make the scene.
Yeah.
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 How Howard got his gym back.
The sequel. Wow. Yeah.
I think my favorite. Let's name our favorite non-actor in the movie because mine, hands down,
helicopter pilot.
It is the fucking dude that helps out Julia Fox. At
oh,
the
that
end.
Guy's name is, I forget
with
his first
tan.
Name, but his
oh,
last name
God.
Is literally Diamond.
Really?
And he's a real guy. He's like
oh,
a real billionaire, like spray tan kind of dude.
Oh, man.
What
that
the
dude.
Hell?
Yeah.
That hair. And in the end, he like legit helps her.
That's misdirection too, because you think he's going to do something super skeezy,
skeezy and creepy,
and then he ultimately just like
he's just a nice guy
helps her out.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I think he's the way I read his character sort of afterward. Because the whole time I was thinking the same thing, like, oh man, she's going to go to his room and he's going to do something really bad.
Yeah,
I think he just likes the company of a young hot woman like that.
He's like he's kind of the old sad guy.
And like they don't have to sleep together. If they do, great.
Right.
But if not, like, come and hang out in my suite.
Yeah.
Order some shrimp cocktail and a lobster and like have a good time.
Yeah.
So interesting.
He just wants the company, probably.
Yeah, Wayne what about you guys?
Wayne Diamond.
No, he was my favorite. He was my favorite by a mile.
Yeah.
By a mile. And not get too sidetracked, but like that was another thing. Like nothing aside from Howard getting killed, obviously. And his brother, which is tragic. Nothing really horrific happens to anybody in this movie.
Well, in a way, like
– Like, save it for the end.
No,
for sure.
no one gets their fingers smashed. There's none of those gambling movie cliches. Yeah.
You're right.
Well, and like that was the thought that I had watching it the first time was kind of like these guys are a little soft on him. Like I think like a real life, you know, heavy and bookie situation, they would be –
He got his ass kicked at one point.
But you don't realize that's his brother
for a hot minute. And that's why he's able to push.
Excuse me. Yeah. Yes, exactly.
That's why he's able to push the envelope so much is because he does have that family connection and Arno's not going to just take it all the way there.
No, you're right.
Did you get the sense that Arno was over his head?
Oh, big time.
With those guys?
The second time through, you can really see the fear in his eyes when he's just like,
I'm beholden to these guys now who are way more hardcore than I am, I signed up for.
Yeah. It's like spiraled out of control for him too, which is what's so scary about the ending when, you know, he shoots him in the head and then the panic that Arno has in that moment. And
I'm implicated.
He's got
now,
the gun against his head. And he's on the counter. He's saying, let me out. I want out, you know?
Yeah.
And then he walks away from him for a second. He makes that one last desperate dash for the door.
No, he's going to.
And then he just shoots him in the head.
I think
too,
there's this sense of, you know, like you said, there isn't much violence in the movie. To me, there is this sense of, with Arno and Howard, like these very well-to-do guys sort of feeling like they can dip their toes into quote-unquote the criminal underworld without having to
get dirty
and really suffer the consequences of how it would be for most people who are deep into this world.
Yeah.
And again, that speaks to the idea of like class differences.
Big time, you know? Big time.
I do think Howard understands it way more than Arno.
Probably, that's a good point, yeah.
Arno probably just out of desperation because Howard was probably just going to blow him off forever, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, my brother-in-law, what are you going to do? You know?
Keep putting him off.
And that's probably – it was out of desperation that he probably turned to these guys in the first place and then set the whole train in motion.
I was – another bit of misdirection is I thought that Julia Fox was going to fuck up the bet somehow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because he gives her these – you know, it's so explicit.
Right.
And what I thought was going to happen was – he was going to think he won the bet, but she had put it in wrong.
But they already did that.
Yeah.
Remember?
Well, he stopped the bet.
He thought he had won big, and his brother stopped the bet. But you're right. No, there's so many things that could have gone wrong.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
She seemed like a little bit of an airhead kind of, like maybe she wasn't going to, you know, follow through or like fuck up or something like that. But she was perfect. She did it just right.
She did exactly right.
She, aside from Wayne Diamond – she was my favorite. Like you said, this was her first acting role.
Yeah,
I think
so. Yeah,
it's not gonna be her last. She's gonna be.
No, yeah.
Oh my god,
pretty hot item. I think
she was just great in this for all the reasons.
But see, I think of her as that's acting. Like,
oh yeah,
Wayne Diamond is sort of a kooky character.
He's being himself.
like she
larger
is
than life.
A true.
I've watched a few video interviews and things with her, and she's. You get the sense that she's very much kind of. Just being herself on camera. She is acting, but her personality is definitely a little bit like this.
Yeah.
And the Safdies seem to—
Well, that's what you do. You play to someone's strengths.
Yeah, the Safdies seem to, if you read interviews with them, they meet somebody interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And in New York, there's plenty of people like that. And they'll start a conversation with them, and then maybe that person will get a call a few weeks later and say, hey, you want to be in this movie?
Right.
You know, and I think they're really good, like we said, at not just identifying people who would— work well in those situations, but just directing them really well. I think, you know, that's something that you could easily overlook with sort of the powerhouse performance of Sandler.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, that they're so good at directing all of these people in smaller roles.
Yeah.
Especially like somebody like KG.
Yeah.
Like, you know,
that's
people.
That's tough, man. These athletes are stiff.
Yeah, yeah. Usually. People who are in
like
the public eye.
Shaq on Curb.
Michael Jordan.
Shaq on Curb Your Enthusiasm is almost painful to watch.
Like, yeah. They get a really good performance out of
Kevin
Garnett.
He's in a lot of scenes,
so too.
Yeah, he really has to, like,
be.
It's not like
intense,
a cameo.
You know?
He is like one of the central characters that really needs to work for this whole thing to.
It could have fallen apart.
Yeah,
and I love this kind of thing where they could have like had to stop shooting if it didn't go well.
Right,
and I love that Kevin Garnett's willingness to sort of have this narrative revolve around something that actually happened to him.
Oh, I bet he's so stoked, dude. He's going to be going to the Oscars.
Yeah.
Dude. And he's going to be the most noticeable guy there.
Like, and do you think that was his actual ring he used in the movie? Probably. His championship ring.
Yeah. Oh, that
they probably
would have
insisted. They would have insisted.
Yeah. When he immediately gets that ring and goes and pawns it.
Right away.
Like, oh, dude.
It's like the junkie going to get his next fix. He had to do it.
Absolutely. Yeah. One of my favorite motifs was the double doors to get into what was the name of the shop again?
I never caught a name.
Yeah, I don't remember.
I think it was the initials or something.
You're right. It was like K
HCM or K whatever. The door motif of the double doors. You got to get buzzed to get in. You're in that little vestibule. Yeah. You got to get buzzed again. It doesn't work sometimes.
Yes.
People are outside trying to get in. Yeah. They're on camera. They worked that for – they milked it for everything they could.
That sequence
so
where they show up and they can't get it to open and they're trying everything to
Everyone's
get it to open.
Everyone's stressed out.
And everyone,
well,
you've
been stressed for this arrival in the first place, right? Oh, God, finally they're here and they can't get in.
But they're brilliant at creating that kind of like – That sense of just being overwhelmed with like too many things happening at the same time,
and hitting the buzzer repeatedly,
and being like, "No, stop doing that. That's not going to help," and all that kind of stuff. Like they're so good. It reminded me actually of certain moments in Punch Drunk Love with Sandler as well, where he's walking around his warehouse,
and
stuff's falling off the shelves,
and he's
trying to talk to somebody, and somebody else is bugging him about this other thing, and he's got a phone call from his sister.
You're right.
You know, it's that sense of again, just like overload, sensory overload, complete, just like panic and anxiety, and they capture it so well here.
But he thrives on it.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
He's not
a very different character.
You know.
Yeah.
Another bit of misdirection there that I just remembered is the shot of the magnet or the whatever
knife,
that file
the
is.
Shiv or whatever,
it is. It shows that shot of it on the floor.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, someone's going to get stabbed with that thing through the eyeball.
Well,
that's how this movie's
like,
going to end.
You know, he's like, they're going to leave, right? When he's placed the bet, they're pissed off at him.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just like, you know, Arno says to him, like, you're an idiot. And they go to leave. And that's what they're going to do. They're going to walk out of the building.
Mm-hmm.
And he gets them buzzed in the first part. And then the second part, that thing falls out purely by chance. And then he looks at it and he has
in
this
the
idea.
Moment, doesn't yeah.
It's a parlay. It's
yes.
like it's like oh, it's like oh I could up this even further.
Let it ride.
Yeah. Jesus. Whereas they could have just gone, and then maybe they intercept her on the way to the casino, where she gets the bed in, and who knows?
Well, I mean, that's why he trapped him, because they were going to get
her.
Right,
right. But you know, it's like things could have played out so differently. It wasn't like he had the plan in his mind that he's going to trap them in there.
He
again,
never
that was
has
pure
a plan
chance
in
too.
His mind.
Yeah.
You know, no. And it's not like he cared about the girl. He cared about the bet.
Yeah, yeah.
I think he cared about her
a little, but
to some extent.
I don't know, man. I don't give him much capacity for caring about anybody other than himself.
Yeah, there's also
maybe.
That moment where the big heavy, I think his name is Phil in the movie, and the actor's name is Keith.
The scary guy.
First time. He's amazing too.
Incredible.
But there's a moment where he's on his cell phone to somebody you don't know who he's talking to or what he's saying, and Sandler sees that happening, and then he goes over to his phone, calls his wife, and makes up the story about a gas leak.
Get out of the house.
Because he's just saying, get out. Go somewhere safe, because they might send somebody to kill you. But he can't say that, so he makes up the thing about the gas leak. But he's getting some sense of the stakes are this high that they might just start killing my family or something.
Yeah.
But he's still willing to do it.
Of course.
That's not going to stop him.
Of course.
Another
one. Because, again, he doesn't care about his fucking family.
Yeah, exactly.
Another one of my favorite scenes, acting-wise, even though the whole movie is just acting powerhouse, is the fight between he and Julia Fox outside the club with the taxi.
Yes.
Yeah.
If you've ever been to New York City, like more than once, on a Friday or Saturday night, and you're out late, 100% chance you have seen a couple fighting outside a club.
Oh,
exactly like this.
For sure.
Yeah. I've seen it dozens of times.
And then when
and it
she's,
was so
yeah.
real.
When she's doing the walk of shame back, kind of.
Yeah, and those
and
girls just, are yelling
and
at
she's
her.
She's just talking shit, you know?
Yeah,
like,
fuck
that's
you.
So real. It's so real.
You're the one standing out on the fucking sidewalk.
Yeah, yeah. Out the cold.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Oh, my God.
Yeah, that's a great moment.
Well, let's pay honor to Adam Sandler here for a second. We've talked around a lot of this.
I know.
But
It's just mind-boggling.
If it will be one of the – and there was a lot of great acting this year, but it will be one of the great crimes if he doesn't win the Oscar, I think.
I know.
He's a lock, right?
Sandman.
and like in terms of the casting, it's so important that it is somebody like Sandler.
Yeah.
That is like inherently, intrinsically, unavoidably likable.
Yeah.
You just want to root for the guy. You just –
I think Brad Pitt talked about that.
Yeah.
On
like
his
no matter what you do, no matter what he does – there's still a part of you that's kind of rooting for him.
Yeah.
And it's so important. There could be so many other actors that might be excellent in other ways, but they don't invoke that sympathy from the audience.
Yeah, like Adam Sandler as a person?
Sean Penn or somebody.
Right, right.
You know,
people
want to punch Sean Penn in the face anyway.
Exactly. You could be a very convincing degenerate gambler, but you would have less sympathy. You'd just kind of be like, well, you made your bed, now you sleep in it kind of thing.
Right.
But Howard, you don't want to see that happen.
No, you don't think Adam Sandler squandered so much social goodwill
because
he's made so many terrible poop joke movies?
Not for me, no.
No?
He's still a lovable guy.
Yeah.
He'll always be Opperman.
Yeah. he has like a real – apparently he's one of the nicest people in Hollywood.
Yeah.
He's extremely loyal to his friends.
Very hard worker, apparently.
That's true.
You know, it's
that's
like
a
if,
good point.
You know, you look at like the whole orbit around
he's
him of all
guy.
These guys that pop up in like every movie he does.
And you can't begrudge a guy for wanting to make $20 million making a dumb comedy.
No, you're right. And also, like I was listening to a podcast where they were saying like he does this so he can hang out with his friends.
Right.
We'll make the next – what is it? The one with Spade and all those grown-ups?
Yeah, exactly.
Grown-ups.
Yeah.
We'll make another grown-up so we can go to Cabo and just kick it with our families.
It's
for –
pretty good to be Adam Sandler.
Well, he has in his contract like that he has to kind of – you know, take his kids to school, pick them up from school every day, like when they're shooting. So he really likes to have this kind of like very, let's say, like traditional, conventional family life.
He had a tuxedo made for his goddamn dog for his wedding.
Aww.
He had a little bulldog and he had a custom tuxedo made.
But he just seems like a phenomenally well-adjusted person given how famous and how rich he is.
But
you know?
Boy, is he good in this. I mean, just vanishes from your consciousness as Adam
and
Sandler.
He's not doing what we think of sort of the Adam Sandler
thing.
Shtick, you know? Whereas even Punch Drunk Love, which he's, I'd say, just as good in, he's still a little more channeling that traditional Adam
Sandler. Sort of the mumbly,
Yeah, where this one, he just, like you said, he disappears into this role, even just the way he walks and the way he delivers lines and the way his voice, he sort of has an accent,
a little bit
of an accent, which just, he disappears into it.
He's wearing prosthetic teeth.
Oh, he is?
They're
like caps or something like that, or veneers. Yeah,
that makes sense.
And he, the only time that I kind of see maybe a little bit of his other performances in this is when he has those flare-ups of anger, when he starts yelling or something. That's when
it's
I kind
to hear Adam Sandler yell.
That's when I can kind of think back to other things.
Yeah.
But his kind of just like, you know, baseline in this movie is something we really haven't seen him do before.
No, and then he also gets the you know, Oscar bait scene, you know, where he finally breaks down.
Mm-hmm.
Which this movie needed, I think. It was because he's so just sort of up here and consistently hustling. KG, come here, come over here. Let me show you what I got over here. This is the most fantastic thing you've ever seen.
Yeah.
It's that for just so long. And then he finally breaks down there. And that scene just like sealed the deal, I think, for him, for this Oscar.
And I love that they let that scene play out, but then they also have the kind of like comedic element of her getting the tattoo and him sort of being like,
because
it's funny, like it's funny, but it's also sad when he's just sort of like, no, I'm not worth it.
Yeah.
I don't deserve that. Like,
brutal.
He's the self-loathing that's kind of buried underneath all that stuff. And then he even has that great aside about like, now we can't even be buried next to each other, which is a Jewish tradition.
Right.
You know, if you're tattooed, you can't be buried in like a...
Oh, I missed that.
Which is it's just a funny aside. That's something that I think is, if you want to talk about the subtext of this movie or some of the deeper themes, there's a lot in there about, you know, Jewish identity in America.
Sure.
You know, obviously the source of the Opal in the first place are the Ethiopian Jews that are kind of stranded and like the obviously like this movie has a scene that takes place during Passover, but when they talked about their other contingencies, if they had to go with a different basketball player and it's going to be a different time of year, there was always going to be some Jewish holiday that was going to coincide with that, you know, whole story happening. So it was very important for the Safdies to kind of work that kind of like, I don't know, like the sense of like trying to assimilate into American society and become quote unquote fully American, but still maintain the tradition in a way.
Yeah, like he's this 100 miles an hour full-time hustler, but he still stops for Passover.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like he has to. He has to honor that.
Yeah.
He even does the reading.
Right, yeah. Right.
And is probably the most present with family that he ever is time, at any other point in the
for
movie.
For that 3 minutes.
Not really on his phone for once.
That's what I'm saying, though, because he clearly respects the tradition and that element of family and being part of that crew, even though it's so weird to see the guy that's literally been chasing after him, trying to beat his ass, sitting across the table from him. And
Bogosian was so good.
He's so good.
Yeah. Judd Hirsch, so good to see him.
Yes.
Yeah.
He's fantastic.
Yeah.
I think we share a birthday. So ever since I was a kid, I was like, "Hey, me and Judd Hirsch." I was a big Taxi fan.
Was that sequence kind of when you really realized they were family, or did you already know?
I don't think there's a way to know before
that
either.
Yeah,
it's a reveal
when
it cuts
to
him like mean mugging across the table.
Wild.
And you're like, "Oh, I see," and then you're still not sure.
But it makes sense. Like, oh, that's why he's being a little. Their relationship always seemed a little strange.
Yeah, yeah.
From the very beginning,
right?
Oh, God,
and it's not really until the scene right after where he's, you know, it's Sandler and Judd Hirsch, and Judd Hirsch is saying to him, like, yeah, I don't know about this guy, you know, like, he said, you know, happy holidays to me, like, it's fucking Christmas, and, you know, he doesn't like the guy, and Sandler's like, he's all right, don't worry about, you know.
Yeah.
He's like, well, hey, he didn't marry your daughter, you know.
Right. So good.
Yeah.
And then the end shot, to me, is the thing that, like, takes and sort of the beginning too, and all this psychedelic use of color, that's what takes this movie and elevates it to something better than just your standard street hustler kind of thing.
Right.
They really just and in fact, I sent this to Noel. I'm going to read it because I was very curious. Have you guys read any of the script online?
He just had it up.
Yeah, we looked at the last page.
And I pointed out I pointed out what you had sent me.
I'm going to read that for the benefit of the listeners. So great. Because the very end, you know, had that great shot zooming in. And they didn't make it super bloody or gross.
No.
This tiny entry
wound
in his cheek.
Yeah.
I can't imagine what the back of his head looks like. but, you know,
Well, there is that pool of blood that kind of spreads. But it's still pretty subtle. It's not like brains everywhere or whatever.
Yeah, the traditional tropey pool of blood.
Yeah, a little small hole under his eye.
In the cheek. Mm-hmm. And then they push in on that wound and go inside of it. And this is how they wrote that in the script, listeners. The zoom closes in on the bullet hole in Howard's face and continues onward into the wound. Swirls of red, pink, and white engulf the frame as we travel through blood, bone, and tissue. The zoom pushes through this material plane into a landscape of kaleidoscopic abstract shapes and flickering iridescent light. The diegetic audio in the KMA Gems, that's the name, showroom decays in a wash of reverb overtaken by a vast soundscape of crystal tinkles and warm electronic tones.
That's great.
Jeez.
I mean, that's fucking
fully
poetry.
Fully realized vision.
They didn't get this idea later. That was from the beginning.
I love the bookending of and it's so funny, too, to kind of like zoom in on the diamond and you're seeing like all these colors and
the
so
opal.
On.
Yeah.
And then it becomes Sandler's colon, you know?
I forgot about
that. And you realize as you retroactively pull out, you're like, oh, I've just been inside the guy's ass. Like, it's very like juvenile and funny, but
it's like a cosmic joke.
Yeah, exactly.
But it also puts you in the scene, which is another important point of a misdirection.
Right.
Is you think he's going to have colon cancer.
Yeah. And
then the doctor
it,
just, it's all good.
Right.
Don't want nothing to worry about.
Yeah. Well, that reminds me, like, a lot of people have drawn comparisons between this movie and the Coen brothers, The Serious Man.
I was just going to say that.
That sense of like, you know, the kind of Book of Job idea of like somebody who's just like doomed and tested and like nothing can go right for you and you're just kind of cursed, profoundly cursed. And so to have that red herring of like he's getting his colon checked and you're not sure what the results are going to be.
Yeah.
And then he's just fine. He even says that thing about.
But they don't play that up a lot either. Like in a lot of movies, I think that would be a constant thing that keeps coming up.
And then it's just like a random phone call later where he's like, everything's clear. And doesn't the doctor say like, colon cancer paid for my house in the Hamptons or something?
Yeah,
Sandler has a great line. Like, he's like, I don't know what it is, Jews and colon cancer. I don't know. And he's like, it just paid for my beach house or whatever.
That's so funny.
And that's in the middle of when Lakeith Stanfield is freaking out.
Yeah.
And like I think there's probably one or two other things happening at the same time. Like he puts the whatever the drink is in the fish tank and that's going down at the same time and the doctor's finally just like, all right, I'm gonna hang up now. Like
I love how important the fish are too. He wasn't I was waiting for him to be like, oh, you fucking asshole.
Yeah.
He's like, oh, come here. I'm going to get you out, my little babies. Yeah. Let me get you out of there. Yeah.
But I
he does have a sweetness to him, actually,
oh, yeah.
at times.
Yeah,
absolutely.
That's the thing.
That's the thing. Yeah, yeah, you're right. You're right.
It may be arbitrary and it may be kind of misplaced. Like he cares more about the fish than it seems like he cares about his family, perhaps.
Right.
he's more immediately concerned for them, but it's still relatable. But
yeah.
I wanted to go back to the last shot again because I feel like the first time I saw it, I was okay on those two shots. It reminded me a little bit of like Fight Club or something where you're kind of like flying around
the
brain, the synapse. It's like, okay, I've kind of seen this before, but it's still pretty cool. But I, in a way, I didn't really know what it was necessarily doing in the movie. And the second time watching it, thinking more in terms of his character being this person that lives this hyper materialist, hyper superficial existence, to then go inside him at the very end to see like the kind of like the uncut gem, the opal within him in a way, and then for that to become, you know, blood, and then for that to become like space, like stars in the sky and so on. To me, it kind of it had like an almost like spiritual dimension where it's saying that this guy contained multitudes. He contained all this, you know, depth and parts of himself that he never explored, that he never knew about because he's living in this society that's so superficial, but that it's a sort of idea, you know, Buddhist or something that we all contain within us. Like
I think
infinity.
Julia Fox sees that too.
Yeah, exactly.
They don't play it up too much, but he's not just a sugar daddy.
Yeah. Yeah, he's a lot more than that.
Yeah. And his wife does not see that.
No.
She hates his guts.
Yeah.
For good reason. For good reason.
Yeah, oh, earned. Absolutely. Let's,
well, she knows she's set either way. Like financially. Like,
oh, yeah.
Yeah.
She just
sure.
wants him gone.
Totally.
I love that scene where, like, she doesn't even say a word when he's in the trunk of the car naked.
Yeah.
And she just looks at him for a minute. It's like, I don't even need to say anything. We know what a screw-up you are.
And the thing, too, is it doesn't get into, like, the kind of over-the-top verbal abuse you might normally see. She just says, you're the most annoying person I've ever known in my entire life.
Yeah.
And that's more cutting than calling him a motherfucker
right.
or slapping him or, like, you know, screaming or whatever. That is more – and you see the puppy dog hurt in his eyes.
That would have been the trophy way to play it, I think, is – for her to blow up and, you know, what the fuck is wrong with you? You don't care about your family. Yeah. And
no, she steals herself. And
he
you can see her, like, just kind of, you know.
He doesn't merit anger.
Like,
he merits
3 years ago, she might have had that reaction.
Right. She's,
but
she's so past
done,
that.
Man. She's gone.
And that's the funny thing, too, is that when she laughs at him, I think it's because she realizes he has such a superficial understanding of what a relationship is and that she's been just completely detached for however long.
Yeah.
And he still thinks, like, oh, you look good in your, your bat mitzvah dress
he
or something?
Tries. I've been thinking, you know, maybe we can work this out.
And it's
out.
Just because things have gone south with Julia Fox that he's like, oh, maybe I should go back to my wife. And
that's
then,
it's
the way he puts Julia Fox down to his wife, where it's like, she's trash. I know she's trash.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. The elevator scene when he tells her off, I don't want you in my life, and then the door closes and he's in there full of people.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, you know, what does he say? It's a great line. just like my life or something
he's
like that.
He's just like, you guys don't know the half of it.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
It's such a trial with this person.
Oh, man. All right. I think we get to the rating now. If you're new to the show, we give ratings between 1 and 5 thumbs. I know you know what I'm going to say. 5 thumbs, my favorite movie of the year, lights out with a bullet.
Yeah, same. 100%.
5 thumbs?
Mm-hmm.
Paul?
4.5 thumbs.
Oh, why the half a thumb? What was it?
There's nothing that I can say to criticize the movie, but just more so comparing it to the other movies I saw this year. Like, I recently did my, like, top 10 of the year, and this was on the list.
Yeah, I saw that.
But it wasn't quite at the top, so that's why.
Was it gold tier or was it silver tier for you? I can't remember.
It was silver tier.
Okay.
So I do it by, like, gold, silver, bronze. Rather than just a simple 1 through 10, I make it overly complicated.
Right, I love it.
And it made the silver tier.
Okay.
So it's, great movie, though.
Casey?
I will go with the full 5. This wouldn't be my number 1 of the year.
Uh-huh.
That would be The Irishman by Martin Scorsese.
Oh, Jesus.
But, wait, I've never heard of that.
But yeah.
That was Scorsese's second best movie of the year.
Oh, Rolling
Thunder
Review. I haven't watched
was...
the documentary yet. I need to. I've heard that's really interesting. Like, it's got characters that weren't actually there
great.
At the time.
Mm-hmm. No, it's super interesting.
What was your favorite movie of the year?
Irishman.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
You assholes.
What was yours? Parasite.
Oh, that's right. That's right. We just covered that.
And Uncut Gems was my second, but they're just two very different kinds of movies.
Yeah.
Even though they're both interesting social commentaries, but they're just like, to me, Parasite's more of like almost a whodunit, like Hitchcocky kind of stylized thing, whereas this is just
pure grit. Just yeah. like, you know. Oh, and by the way, I just looked up there's an amazing article on Interview. It's Uncut Gems, handsome older man, Wayne Diamond, establishes a new legacy. And he is apparently a very wealthy New York socialite type dude. And he got his start in the not in the Diamond District, in the Garment District.
Oh, okay.
And used to be a really weird, druggy, clubby kind of guy, which you could imagine. And the interviewer sits down with him at some bar and he drinks like 5 vodkas and 2 red wines at like 2 o'clock in the afternoon on Monday.
Amazing. Hey, so, Wayne Diamond's going to be Wayne Diamond.
Yeah.
Ramsey, producer, let's hear your thumbs.
5 thumbs.
5 thumbs? Nice. Any other comments?
Favorite movie of the year.
All right.
Yeah.
There you have it.
I do. Before we go, we should also shout out Darius Kanji, the director of photography.
Sure.
Who is legendary in his own right and doing something very, very different here than he normally does in his films, mm-hmm. where he likes to work on much wider lenses typically.
He's sort of like the
Vittorio Storaro idea of like painting with light is very much what Kanji is more comfortable in, let's say.
Oh, wow. He did Delicatessen.
Oh, it's ridiculous.
Some of my favorite movies.
Just look at everything he's done. It's insane. Yeah. Massively talented cinematographer. And for him to adapt that kind of fastidious, like perfection-based style to this film, which is so much more about being able to shoot in any direction, which cinematographers usually hate because you want a light to the shot, not to the room. Working on way longer lenses.
Yeah.
They had a lens on this that they talked about on the podcast with Paul Thomas Anderson, actually, mm-hmm. who also just worked with Darius Kanji on Anima, the Tom York short.
Was that the A24?
Yes.
Podcast
yes.
that they were
yeah,
on?
Yeah, I highly recommend checking that out. But there's like a 350mm lens that they found, anamorphic lens that, that's a ridiculously long lens. And you put that on the camera and it's like, you're not going to be able to like track
unwieldy.
The action. Yeah, it's super
Any
unwieldy.
Any little thing will be a jitter. Right?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. exactly. And it works beautifully in this film. And there's so much more to say about just the technical aspect of this film. That's very, very impressive. It's a mix of film and digital, mostly film, but some of the nighttime exteriors are digital. But it all feels completely
seamless.
And I feel like we should mention the cinematographer Sean Price Williams, who they worked with previous to this, and Kanji to come in and kind of like step up the game or just bring them to that next level of glossiness but still being gritty at the same time.
Yeah. I got to imagine that other cinematographer was bummed out.
I know. I wonder a little bit about that. I feel kind of bad because –
because it sort of bit his style a little bit.
Yes, certainly.
And like you said,
pushed
it over the, but the whole thing was a more over the top version or a more dialed in version of Good Time.
Yes, because Sean Price Williams is very well known for his handheld and his like super telephoto close ups of faces and so on.
Right. And for playing Stifler.
Yeah.
Oh, no, wait. Sorry. Sean Williams.
Different one, yes.
Bad joke. All right, guys, almost a perfect score, except for Tall, dumb opinion, and your half a thumb. I got a place for your half a thumb, my friend.
What can I say? I got to be the contrarian. Uh-huh.
No, I love it. I love it. That's great. Almost a perfect score. Go see it, Uncut Gems. Can't wait to see it again.
I'm really pumped to see it again tonight.
Emily was like, would I like it? And I went, no, you would not. Emily does not like anxiety-inducing films. I was like,
then stay
far, far away.
Yeah. I'm taking my girlfriend tonight. I'm not sure if she's going to like it or not, but I really hope she does.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks, guys. This is a great one.
Thank you.
Yeah.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.